cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
As we promised, we wanted to get to a few of the most read stories on this Monday. This next one included, it's about how M&A bankers, they're kind of busy again after the slowest start to a year in two decades. I mean, Tim, there was a bunch of stuff going on over the weekend, apparently.
Yeah, more than $40 billion plus in potential transactions came to light over the weekend. And what does it say about deal activity in the broader market environment? Just a handful of the questions we want to get to with Bloomberg News deals reporter Crystal C, who's right here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Okay, so first up, just remind us the 2022, how bad it was, and where we are so far in 2023.
So 2022 was not great. M&A volume for investment banks down 31% last year. So bankers are getting smaller bonuses. And January, the last month, it was the quietest, like Harrow said, since 2003 for the beginning of the year. So it was lousy
last year, right?
It was bad. It was not good. And it was a couple of different reasons. People are not confident because of the financing market. And when you have a tough financing market, traditional lenders get very jittery about giving out loans. And a lot of banks actually incurred losses on these big LBO transactions. And that made them even less confident later on in the year. So a lot of these reasons combined with management not feeling like, they could do a transaction easily also made the M&A transaction volume go down. But this Monday, we finally have a merger Monday in the second month of the year. So it's interesting. It's also across different sectors.
So let's talk about it, because mining seemed to be a big one.
Mining is a big one. We don't really see many mining deals, but when we do, it's gigantic. And like this one, there's a U.S. and Australia angle here. Newmont and Australia's Newcast Mining announced a merger. It's the biggest deal this year so far, $17 billion. And we also see things across storage, self-storage. There is financial services with Rothschild family trying to take the company private. $4 billion U.S., not the biggest deal, but is a name that we all follow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there big pictures that it can paint for us about what 2023 is going to look like when it comes to the economy? Is there more certainty here finally?
I think it all comes down to interest rate and the financing market. A lot of these deals, most LBOs hinge on leverage, leverage buyouts, right? So as long as the financing markets improves, we will see more deals come back. And we also see the comeback of private lenders. A lot of these private equity firms now have credit that they're willing to back, not their own, but some of other people's or
this
other
is private. The private credit market, right? That really seems like everybody was talking about big time last year.
That's right. So private credit is an alternative resource that a company can use to tap the M&A market. But also there is something called, seller's assistance. So if you're a friendly acquirer, you can negotiate with the seller and they can give you a little bit of a cushion, write a check, or you can pay them back later on. So there are many ways you can try to get a deal done, but you have to be creative in this market.
We've certainly seen rates go down, at least as a result of what, bond traders think is going to happen and what the Fed is going to do. But at the same time, Jay Powell has said, may not cut rates this year. We've got a lot of work to do. I've been kind of beating that drum for almost a week now. Has the credit market changed?
Yeah,
has financing changed?
Financing market is still tough. It's not drastically improved compared to end of last year. So I don't think immediately we will see a flurry of transactions, and we'll see many, many merger Mondays from now on. And you can also see that reflecting in Wall Street personnel changes. You see a lot of layoff across Wall Street. And
including in the deal space.
Including in the deal space. M&A bankers are not having as tough a time compared to the capital markets bankers. But you also see that, you know, banks are expecting less work in transactions, and therefore they need less people.
So just because we're seeing some activity doesn't necessarily mean we're going to see a bunch more this year.
Not necessarily immediately, but a lot of deal makers are saying that in the second half we could expect more.
I am also curious that if we continue to see some rises, I know in equities we're seeing a little bit of a different tone certainly today, and I felt like, you know, late last week. But if we continue to see markets go up, are we likely to see more kind of stock deals being done because they've just got a greater currency? I mean, obviously the targets, if they're public, potentially have gotten then more expensive as well. But does that often lead to more deals as well?
Yeah, we're seeing some stock deals. Actually, just this week, yesterday, there was a hostile takeover. There was a bear hug letter where one storage company was trying to acquire the other one in an all-stock merger. And not only are they giving stocks, they're also putting in an extra dividend as a sweetener. So there are many ways you can structure deals. But equity, you know, it's not traditionally the most attractive.
Right.
And when you have a shareholder on board members trying to evaluate these transactions, it's going to be less appealing than an all-cash transaction.
Hey, talk a little bit more about private credit. Carol alluded to the fact that, you know, I think you were referring probably to when we were at Milken, Carol.
Yeah.
Private credit.
Just the private markets,
of last year?
Yes.
We talked so much about private credit. What does that look like for 2023?
Yeah, private credit is a really, really big topic. Every private equity firm, every firm that started as a private equity firm has pivoted, well, also diversified into private credit. And it's interesting because, I mean, people talk about the potential conflict of interest here, right? When you're really pricing things properly, but it's obviously a huge pool of capital, and it adds on top of whatever private equity have already raised in their regular funds. So it's an interesting pool of resources, but obviously traditional investment banks, lenders are still the bread and butter or the still main source of capital in this M&A market.
Crystal, what are you hearing in terms of from bankers specifically? Are they saying, wait, we've got a lot of things in the pipeline. People are just waiting to pull the trigger. We just want to kind of get a little bit more certainty about what the Fed's doing and what the economy's doing.
Yeah, I think the joke is that you will never encounter a banker that is not optimistic.
That's fair.
So there are always something that they're working on. I don't think anyone can very confidently say that there will be mega deals in the first half, but there's hope.
It's like what Neil Kashkari told the New York Times last month, right? And it's quoted in the cover of Business Week. It's a notoriously optimistic crowd on Wall Street.
It is true, right? Right. There's optimism out there. So what are you keeping an eye on? Are there certain sectors, though, nonetheless, you guys are reporting on stuff, you know, waiting for things to happen. But in the meantime, you know, you're also just kind of trying to read the tea leaves. So what do you kind of follow?
So there are a lot of activism going on right now. And we just came out of the Salesforce, Elliott. That hasn't really entirely settled. This week, there are some IPO coming back, actually. So green shoots of the market's coming back. There are three deals that's supposed to price just this week. So it's not really M&A, but people in the deals world are doing work.
Are you watching Disney with the activism, too, as well?
Yeah, Pels is getting really busy with that and with his consumer company. He's also in Unilever. So Disney is a really interesting situation.
What about when it comes to private equity firms that are going after targets that have been beat up in the public markets? Do you think we see more take privates?
So a lot of the IPO that went, the company that went public in the past 2 years, actually a lot of them are trading way below offer price. And that means they could be prime target for private equity. And we've seen some of these deals pan out. And even the companies, for instance, like Weber, the barbecue grill company, was taken private by BDT, which was a private
And they just went public, went public during the pandemic, right?
They did went, yes. And it was like the whole, you know, Traeger, Weber, Solo Stove.
Because we're all outside grilling all.
That's right.
Carol was outside grilling all our Impossible and Beyond burgers.
That's a no, as you well know. I am curious, are you hearing anything when it comes to deal activity, interest in things AI related? You could say no. Although the stocks, I mean, they're really on the move. Any kind of little player that's got an AI connection.
Well, we aren't, but I mean, they can probably help us write some stories from now on. Like,
That's
don't
good.
Say that. Don't say that. Crystal, thank you so much. Gut check on what's going on with M&A. Crystal C, she's deals reporter here at Bloomberg News here in our interactive broker studio. I mean, we're going to talk about this with our colleagues in a little bit, but those AI stocks are just
It's like 2017 all over again when they put blockchain. Like, what was it? Long Island Iced Tea Blockchain Company, and then the stock shot up as a result of that?
It's so true.
Do you remember that?
Just be like
5 years ago,
blah, 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 blah,
ago?
Blah. AI.
Yeah.
And you're off and running.
It's pretty incredible. Some of these stocks, though, if you take a look at the big picture, Carol, like back to the IPO days, like C3.ai, for example, it's not even close to where it was when it IPO'd.
No, a little perspective,
BuzzFeed,
right?
Too.
Right, exactly. And they're pretty small cap, micro cap kind of companies. But nonetheless, all of a sudden, investors are looking at the group in a big way.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Safe to say we are all a bit obsessed with ChatGPT, right? Since Microsoft's $10 billion investment, we are hearing about it in earnings calls. Google did their own, albeit much smaller AI deal. We talked about it with Kathy Wood last week. And then there is a Bloomberg Business Week story that you can find online that definitely takes it into account.
Yeah, our team put ChatGPT to the test on a Wharton exam. With more, we've got Dimitra Kesanidis, a senior editor at Bloomberg News, on the phone in New York City, along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So Joel, how did ChatGPT do on that Wharton exam?
Well, we're going to find out. I do think just in general, it is causing existential crises everywhere you look, right?
Speak for yourself, man.
Yeah, it's all going to be great. And I think, you know, an MBA or tests in general, I've heard from some professors who are like, I've had to upend my entire curriculum to account for ChatGPT. So that, you know, proving that, you know, an AI program didn't actually do the student's homework. AI ate my homework. I think we'll get used to that. So, Dimitra, take us to Wharton and the professor who you based the story around.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are all good points. Christian Terwiesch teaches at Wharton. And, you know, it started as kind of a fun conversation over the holidays with his sons, who both have dealt with other AI programs. You know, we're intrigued by it. Our B-School's coverage sometimes is about research that can feel very out of touch with what's going on in the real world. And Professor Terwiesch was very quick and nimble to say, hey, let me see what this thing is about, all the hubbub. Let me give it an exam that I've given to my students. It did quite well. It did above average. It got a B-. But it is not, you know, the context of a business school course and a business school exam is not the kind of context in which, you know, students can realistically put the chatbot to take the exam for them. That's not to say that the concerns of educators across the country, as the professor noted to me, are not legitimate. I mean, there are many educators with far fewer resources than a Wharton professor who do have to contend with the reality of how students are going to use this. He used this as a way to see what it's all about, and then as a way to say, hey, this is very powerful. It's doing quite well. It's answering in ways that legitimately might pass as a student. How can we use something like this more creatively in our classroom? Our job as educators is to really think about how to bring education along and be more creative and really spark imagination. And so this is the first step of this one professor in trying to do that.
Did the professor give you any idea how he would actually use it in a classroom?
Well, I mean, he gave me an idea off of something that we talked about in the conversation. Like, let's say he was teaching philosophy, for example, not business, but you can swap out people. And I mentioned this in the Q&A, and he says, you know, I want you to go back to your libraries and to your apartments and research, you know, the work we studied on Sartre or on, you know, Camus and Sartre. Write me a 500-word essay on the differences between these two. You know, they might go home and decide to have ChatGPT write the paper for them. But what he might do that would be even more effective is have ChatGPT really engage in a conversation. That's what these chatbots do with students. and step in as the philosophers, the French philosophers, and do something that might spark some more creative ideas with the students. And so he, as the professor, could certainly be in a position to introduce the use of the chatbot in that way.
Dimitri, I got to jump in for a second, because how did it do when it came to, which I bet at the whole student body universe is saying, I hope I can do math. How did it do on math?
Oh, it doesn't. They don't do well on math, at least in this instance. And he said that that's something that, I think we see that across the universe of stories that have been done by Bloomberg and many others. What you said is true. Everybody's kind of in a frenzy about this right now. Mathematics, it did not do well. And, I mean, Professor Turvish was very funny about that. I mean, it's like you're a computer dude. Like, you can't actually, put some numbers together. And, in fact, numbers is where it was really tripped up. And it was more in language that it was far more impressive, and in logic and application of logic. So it was all around super surprising to him. I think that he, as well as many others who are engaging with ChatGPT right now, it's a little tough to do. You go to the website. It's so popular. There are so many users that generally what you're going to get is a message that says ChatGPT is at capacity right now. So you can't even try it because the world is trying ChatGPT. But he did it. He did it quickly. He wrote a paper and he said, I was really impressed and I think I'm going to try to think more creatively about how to use this. And I think that in that context, I mean, I want to be clear, we came at it with a very specific sort of context of B schools, teaching business, teaching case management and so on. You know, there's probably going to be space for something like this. It will emerge in time. I don't think that we have the answers right now in terms of this semester, how is ChatGPT right. going to become, a stand-in for something in the curriculum. We're not there yet.
But B-minus is B-minus. Take that, computer.
Not a D, but also not an A.
Yeah.
I mean, everything's on a curve in business school anyway.
Yeah.
So, kind of doesn't matter.
There you go.
So one of the things that stuck out to me, Dimitri, was him saying, we are not running out of work. What is shifting is the efficiency frontier. And I'm curious, this would be an optimistic take, I think, on ChatGPT, but what is it? What is the potential here in a classroom?
I mean, again, I think that there are ways he thinks to use it and engage it to be added. I hate to use the word additive, but to engage brains and students in a way that there isn't time enough in the classroom, but it's to extend the learning that's already happening. You're going to the internet. You're looking for videos of things as it is. You're looking up resources. So this might take it to another level in which it's not as passive, though. It might be more active. He does have a far more, let's say, positive and optimistic view, which is that these things should be seen as tools that are very innovative and technologically advanced, that we should not really be so fearful of them as replacements for actual people in many settings.
I mean, Dimitri, you wrote this Q&A, not ChatGPT.
Are you sure, though?
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
did a robot do this interview?
The big secret. It's so funny. I mean, I was just reading an interview that a former colleague of mine from a time I worked at a company called The American Lawyer, he did a Q&A with ChatGPT and just posted it on LinkedIn. And he's asking ChatGPT, if Nike wants to sponsor you, will you accept the sponsorship? And ChatGPT is like, I am an open platform. I am not somebody who's going to give in to sponsorship by private interests. It's a very interesting back and forth, and it's actually a real engaged, intelligent conversation that this individual has.
Right. Everyone sells out for a price, Joel, right?
Well, Dimitri, it's not real.
Or
B minus. It's a computer.
I can't wait for Google's Bard, which is also in the headlines now, to have a competition or a conversation.
Bard, that's an
AI
optimistic name for the.
All right, we got to run. Joel, Dimitri, thank you.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I've got to say, it's something we've talked a lot about. It's captivated us for over a week. It was the opening skit for SNL this past weekend. What was that Chinese balloon really up to? What does it mean for the renewed tensions seemingly between Washington and Beijing after the U.S. shot down the vessel on Saturday?
Very pleased to have back in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio Andy Brown, former editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy, who spent three decades in Asia as both China editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Andy leads the China Hub as a partner at Brunswick Group. It's a critical issues advisory firm. Andy, good to have you with us. We've been so eager to talk to you about this. We spent a good portion of Friday afternoon talking about it. What was going through your head as you looked up at images of the sky over the last week and saw this balloon floating over the United States?
This is bizarre. This is really crazy.
Yeah.
Nobody knows really what happened. More importantly, it's hard to know what's going to happen next. I think we can say with some confidence that the image of this balloon, this crumpled Chinese airship, shredded by a sidewinder missile, collapsing into the Atlantic Ocean, is a pretty apt metaphor for the state of U.S.-China relations and a wake-up call. I think it's a real warning that we are one serious accident away from a major geopolitical crisis and one that could spiral out of control. And I don't want to make light of this balloon episode. I mean, it shouldn't have been in U.S. airspace. It was obviously an invasion of U.S. sovereignty. Right. I mean, it was reckless. It was provocative. But, you know, nobody died, mercifully. Nobody was injured. It didn't get much intelligence. The Pentagon even says this, not much more than the Chinese could have got from their own, can already get from their own satellites. And in intelligence terms, there's going to be a net plus for America. They're probably going to scoop it all, the bits and pieces, off the bottom of the Atlantic and get a trove of information about Chinese spycraft.
Not an accident by China?
You know.
And does that matter?
I actually probably am more inclined to believe the cock-up theory that, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine that the Chinese leadership deliberately went out to scupper a visit to China. They needed this visit. You know, I mean, they want to repair damage to with their relations with the West. You know, I think it's we know that China has a balloon program. They float these things off fairly regularly. It's quite possible that, you know, somebody who floats off the balloons didn't get the memo. You're not supposed to do this while Anthony Blinken is packing his bags to come to Beijing. I mean, there are darker theories. You know, maybe somebody did get the memo but decided that they wanted to sabotage the meeting. I don't know. It's not the first time that something insane like this has happened. I was in China in 2011. Robert Gates, then defense secretary, was just about to have a meeting with then president Hu Jintao, and China tested 2 hours before his meeting. They tested a stealth fighter. This was a really big deal. It looked like a middle finger to Gates. He went ahead ahead with the meeting, mm-hmm. gets into the meeting, says to Hu Jintao basically what the hell happened. And Hu Jintao looks, you know, completely mystified, obviously didn't know, looked at a general who was sitting there and said, well, you know, what's the story? And the general sort of shuffles his feet. I mean, these things happen. This is what happens in a Cold War.
Andy, I'm pretty struck by the comment that you made that this image perfectly represents U.S.-China relations, and we are just, you know, one sort of accident away from a serious escalation. What has you concerned specifically?
Just imagine what would happen if two aircraft collided, a U.S. aircraft and a China. And this did happen, by the way, in 2001. Imagine what would happen, you know, if two ships collided at sea. And there are hundreds of military warplanes, naval vessels churning and wheeling around Taiwan, South China Sea, East China Sea, around Japan. And unlike the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States, we don't have protocols. We don't have rules of the road for what. I'd be very interested to find out, you know, what messages were going backwards and forwards while this thing was playing out, while the airship was sort of cavorting over Montana. And in fact, this is precisely why Secretary of State Blinken was going to Beijing to talk about guardrails after the two presidents, Xi Jinping and President Biden, met in Bali at the G20. Do you remember at the end of last year, agreed that, you know, the two sides, and they acknowledged that there was a risk of conflict and they had to avert that possibility. This was what the Blinken visit was all about. And now not only have we not arrested the downward spiral in relations, but relations have taken another lurch down.
So can Blinken go over there at some point in the future and things get fixed, or...
Yeah, I think this is fixable. We'll see. There's going to be an awful lot. There'll be a lot of headlines in the next few days and weeks. They'll be dredging up the bits that they can find from the airship. And you know, look, the Chinese say it was a weathercraft. Okay, you know, I mean, good cover story. No, we'll find out sooner.
Okay, cover story.
Right.
We'll find out.
Or not.
We'll find out sooner rather than later. Right. I mean, one way or another. But yes. Both sides, I think, understand the risks, and both are keen to de-escalate. But what really came out of this episode was how much political pressure was on the U.S. president immediately, right off the bat. You know, why aren't you shooting this down?
Right.
How did you let it float around for so long? You show weakness. You imagine what would happen in a serious crisis. The pressure on both leaders to look tough, not to de-escalate.
So... what do you think about next here in terms of this relationship, or what do we watch out for? We know it's been a tricky relationship, I feel like, now for some time, right? It's always been complicated, but it does feel like it's been less friendly, certainly through the Trump administration, and it feels like Biden has continued a lot of things. So I don't know, what do you... You have clients, you have people that consult
with
you?
Yeah, our clients are business people, and they're looking at that, and they're obviously disappointed. Look, you know, they've been grappling with a lot over the last 2-3 years with, you know, fallout from China's tacit support for Russia, with COVID zero, with the Nancy Pelosi visit and the aftermath of that. Everybody is saying, my goodness, have we made the wrong bet on China? They have to now look at war plans, scenarios, but, you know, and this doesn't help.
But here's what struck me last week, Andy. Apple's earnings were miserable, in the words of our own Mark Gurman. One strength, China.
Mm-hmm.
That company is so reliant on China. Disney, Nike, the list certainly goes on. What does it mean for executives who have to do business with the country and in the country?
Well, it's a good question. So you know, Apple is in China, and you know, extricating itself from China is impossible, at least in any near-term time frame. They're trying at the margins, bits and pieces, going down to Vietnam, India, and so on. But yes, businesses have to engage with China. Don't forget, look, you know, China is the engine of the global economy. Last year, it grew 3%. It was 8% in 2021. This year is supposed to grow 5.5%, and Bloomberg economists reckon that is adding the equivalent of a Nigeria. So look, China is an attractive market. You know, you have to be there, but geopolitics is now weighing much, much more on CEO minds than it ever did in the past.
Is there a region of the world? Is it the China seas that we're keeping an eye on? Like, what are you watching geographically that could be the thing that maybe complicates this even
Taiwan.
More? It's Taiwan.
Everybody's looking at Taiwan. And I think that's what comes to mind anytime you have a crisis like this, even a crisis on this scale, and you think to yourself, look, you know, the big one is out there, and that is some kind of miscalculation over Taiwan, and tensions over Taiwan are ratcheting up. We know that Kevin McCarthy is potentially right. planning a visit there. The new Select Committee on China apparently is going to hold what they call some kind of field hearing on Taiwan, in Taiwan. So that is precisely the problem, that if you got an accident occurring under those circumstances in that context, it could be really serious.
Because you talk about the pressure on Biden, that if something happens, how much pressure will be on him to react?
And how much pressure on Xi Jinping to react? There is no more important issue for him than Taiwan.
Well, as Tim mentioned coming into you, we really wanted to get you to weigh in on this. I know everybody's been having a lot of fun, but it felt very serious as this story was unfolding. And you really explained why. Andy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Always appreciate it. Andy
Good
Brown.
Good to see you, Andy.
He's partner at Brunswick Group, joining us in our Interactive Brokers studio on this Monday.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, Tim. So as we mentioned, shares of Bed Bath & Beyond, they're up nearly 40% year-to-date, still down more than 80% from a high back in August of 2022. It's been often grouped among the meme stocks actively traded by retail investors, and the company has indicated it's getting ready for a potential bankruptcy filing. How it got there and who's to blame? That is the subject of another one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg today.
With more on her story, let's bring in Jeanette Newman, Bloomberg News, U.S. luxury retail and personal care industries reporter. She's with us right now in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So, Jeanette, who is to blame for what's happening at Bed Bath & Beyond?
Well, there are many people to blame is the short answer. And I think, I mean, one thing that is to blame is Amazon. But I think Amazon kind of, you know, whenever there's retail bankruptcies, people kind of cat, you know, oh, this is another one bites the dust because of Amazon. And it's much more complicated than that, because obviously there's a lot of retailers out there who are competing against
right.
Amazon, and they're doing fine. So Amazon is, you know, somewhat to blame for where Bed Bath & Beyond ended up, but it's a small portion of the blame. And just over the past, you know, several years, there's been a series of management missteps and miscalculations that led the company to where it is today. So it's structural forces with Amazon, but also, you know, mistakes by managers over the past several years.
Well, talk to us about some of the mistakes, because we've been talking about retail, I feel like, for over a decade in terms of how we got overstored, too many strategies out there, and we've seen fallout. I mean, we even just see, I mean, what's going on here post-pandemic of just so many retail that have whittled down, you know, their stores, their brick and mortar stores. So what specifically, though, in the Bed Bath & Beyond strategy, Jeanette, that they just kind of messed up with?
So they definitely didn't invest enough in online. So that left them kind of, you know, flat-footed competing against Amazon.
Kind of that omni-channel, right? I can go to the store, I can buy online from you guys and all that good stuff.
Exactly. They didn't do that well. They spent a lot of money buying lots of companies, for example, Bye Bye Baby, Christmas tree shops. They spent a ton of money, billions and billions on share buybacks. That was kind of the previous leadership. Then a new CEO a couple years ago took over. He was the former head of chief merchant at Target. So it was a really big deal. Mark Tritton, people were really excited about what he was going to do to potentially turn this this company around. And in fact, he was not able to turn it around. And, you know, long story, hopefully people can read the story, but some of what he did was also double down on share buybacks. So spent $1 billion at a time when the company didn't have necessarily that cash on hand, and also made a pivot to white label or private label brands. And that's something that for a retailer can actually make a lot of sense, because essentially you're cutting out the middleman, right? So it's like you're going to the factory in China and you're sourcing the products.
Doesn't it seem crazy in hindsight? Because it's the kind of store you like, I'm out of candles, or I need some towels, or I need a rug for the bathroom. I go in, bam, do it, go.
Right, right. And so the private label thing can make sense because there's higher margins, it's more profitable for companies. But they did it at like when the pandemic hit, so they weren't able to effectively source all of their new products from China. And also they ended up doing it at the expense, perhaps unintentional, but at the expense of some of these well-known brands that took people to the store for decades. KitchenAid, OXO, all those brands. So now they had all their own new brands that people didn't know, didn't recognize, didn't resonate with the customer, and there wasn't the same availability of the KitchenAids and the OXOs. So customers, then that started the company on a downward spiral, right? Customers go there, they don't see what they want. The company's burning cash. Cash is, you know, their cash pile is starting to dwindle. Suppliers start to get really nervous. Because they think that they're not going to get paid.
Right.
Suppliers pull back. Shelves end up being empty. Starts a vicious cycle where then
why
you
would
go
someone
there.
Go if a shelf is empty?
Yeah, yeah. So it's just this downward spiral that they got caught in.
And they were known for having the inventory. You could just see it piled up.
It was even more striking, I think, because of it had been kind of like a stack it high and let it fly is what they would call it in retail back in the day. You know, so I think that was one of the things that also it was just such a stark contrast to what the company had been, and it's been in that downward spiral now for nearly a year. So a downward spiral that's very difficult to get out of.
So how long is this downward spiral and what could happen? I mean, what could the future of Bed Bath & Beyond look like on the other side? Is there another side?
We have reported that our colleagues on the bankruptcy team have reported that liquidation is possible. So liquidation meaning, a la Barney's, it doesn't exist. Circuit City doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Toys R Us, at least in the U.S., doesn't exist anymore. We have reported that is possible because of the dire financial situation that they're in.
Is there a winner in this that's not...
And I just want to point out, shares of Bed Bath & Beyond have been halted because of volatility. Stock right now is up 120%.
Okay.
It's
a lot of meme stock. And because this bankruptcy process has been... The company itself said that they are likely... Or that they could file for bankruptcy. And so kind of since that's happened, there's been a ton of volatility.
But is there a winner if people can't go to Bed Bath & Beyond or Bye Bye Baby? Is it a company like Target? Is it Amazon? Who could some winners be? Because people need this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. I mean, in past retail bankruptcies, there often hasn't been a huge jump at any one retailer. You know, when Circuit City went out of business, it wasn't like Best Buy saw a huge jump. But
because
it dispersed.
It's a slow decline of something where people have already been going to those places anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes people end up buying less. Like if you buy more because you have a store near you, and if you don't have that store near you, then some of the demand actually just also dissipates. So there's going to be winners, Target, Amazon, but I don't think none of these companies are going to see this huge boost that all of the traffic from Bed Bath is going to go to them.
What?
My apartment's not so happy about this. Okay, so we got a baby on the way. We got a baby on the way, so we need Bye Bye Baby, and then my wife really likes Face Values, which is part of the Bed Bath & Beyond umbrella too.
It is, and look, I mean, a lot of people are not very happy. You know, I mean, this was a beloved brand, the famous 20% coupons that drove a lot of people to the store, and also there's a lot of in its heyday in 2017, the company had 65,000 employees. Now it has less than 30,000, but those people's jobs are at risk. We've written about how their severance payments they haven't received their severance pay. So there's also a lot of workers and employees who are at risk here.
I mean, I do wonder with, the growth of things like Target and other stores and online where it is so easy to get so many of the goods that they offer and get them pretty quickly. Is it just a case we didn't need that model? I'm curious what retail experts have said that just that model was just not needed anymore because it was kind of a one-stop shopping for a lot of different things, right?
At least what I have heard and what I have learned is that it's not necessarily that the model wasn't needed, is that the model wasn't well executed. I think there is still space for this model. And in terms of what might happen next, you might see the company might go into bankruptcy. Then sometimes companies will buy up the intellectual property and you'll have an online version of Bed Bath & Beyond. That happened with Pier 1, for example. There's no more Pier 1 stores left.
Toys R Us,
but there's
too,
a Pier
right?
1.com and a Toys R Us. So,
so how loved is Bye Bye Baby is Bed Bath & Beyond, apart from in the Master household.
Notwithstanding. I think it was one of the biggest home goods, still is one of the biggest home goods stores in the U.S. So I think that it is quite beloved, and I think that's what, creditors in the company right now are trying to hash out. How much is it loved and how much is that going to pay, essentially.
How much money do they have before they've got to do something?
I mean, they are actively in bankruptcy talks as we are speaking. They are in bankruptcy. They are in bankruptcy talks. So they've been burning cash for about a year. And you know, in the last quarter, sales fell about 25% year over year. I mean, that's a ton.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Jeanette, thank you so much. Jeanette Newman, she is U.S. luxury retail and personal care industries reporter at Bloomberg News here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, folks, just about 16 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. We're bouncing around off our highs and lows, but we are right across the board, as you heard from Charlie, down the most when it comes to the NASDAQ, down about 1%.
It's very good to have back with us Amanda Agati, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group, joining us via Zoom in Philadelphia. Amanda, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
We're doing okay, trying to figure out what the Fed is saying, what Jay Powell is going to say tomorrow, what a very much hotter than expected jobs report on Friday says about the Fed's path. What are you looking at?
Well, it certainly is challenging to make sense of the market madness. That's how I'm sort of describing it these days. We've also been describing this market as being a little bit delusional, a little bit deranged, perhaps even unhinged, all with dramatic effect. But I think really at the end of the day, you know, what we're seeing in terms of leadership to start off this year really does not align with the outlook. It's the same outlook that was in place last year. And at the end of the day here, the Fed is still firmly in the driver's seat. So a really significant disconnect in terms of market action.
That's so interesting that you say that, because a listener got in touch and sent me the Bed Bath & Beyond price action today, which at one point was up triple digits and now is up 90%. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is like 2021 all over again. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think investors are really conditioned to everything moving at warp speed. We've been in a high volatility regime since the onset of the pandemic, and I think investors would just like this whole Fed tightening cycle to be over with at warp speed. And so that's why we keep saying market's very much fighting the Fed on this, but it's a longer for longer dynamic here in play. Especially with what we're seeing around inflation drivers being pretty sticky, and certainly what we're seeing in that red hot jobs report, you know, potentially more rate hikes ahead, a higher terminal rate, just a longer overall tightening cycle. And so I think that's really where we're going to start to see some potential disconnects in terms of this market price action.
Amanda,
it's just too soon to claim victory.
Our Steve Matthews caught up with the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Rafael Bostic, who said that the strong jobs report for January raises the possibility that the central bank will need to increase interest rates to a higher peak than policymakers had previously expected. And just talking about doing a little more work, he doesn't vote on policy this year, but he said officials need to understand if the jobs report was an anomalous reading, in which case he would be inclined to look through this a bit, but said that the committee could also consider moving back to a 50 basis point hike if needed to, though that's not his expectation. And he supported last week's downshift in rates. A lot of ifs and buts were candy nuts kind of a thing. There's just so many different scenarios that we could see. So at this point, how do you value the market? Are we fairly valued? Are we still overvalued? Are we a little undervalued in some areas?
Well, I would say in general, we're still sitting at overvalued levels. There's no question that we're in a better place to start this year than we were last year. That feels like an understatement. But we're certainly not priced at recessionary valuation levels. In fact, as we're seeing earnings growth start to come down as a function of Q4 earnings season, we're actually seeing this paradox of multiples expanding. So 18 times a forward PE on the S&P 500, nowhere near priced at recessionary valuation level. So we think there is probably another 10 to 15% downside here, especially if the Fed keeps going.
Wait, are you though, is that only if we get a recession or even no?
Well, I would say it's sort of one in the same. So there's never really been a tightening cycle in history on the part of the Fed where they've raised rates to, well, I guess it's 5.1% or higher as a function of the dot plot and the terminal rate without tipping us into recession. So my view and PNC's view is if we go that far or even higher, the recession becomes a foregone conclusion. So I think both of those catalyze a bit of a downdraft here over the next, you know, few months.
So you say a 10 to 15% decline from where we are in the S&P 500 right now.
Yeah,
that's your base case?
Well, considering how far we've moved to start the year, that's probably a little light in terms of downside, but that's basically what we think could happen. What's interesting though is I think it could be somewhat short-lived. Is if we do get that eventual Fed pause, even if we don't get a cut, I think there's a lot of power in a Fed pause that could add back a couple of valuation multiple points seemingly overnight. So it could be a very interesting returns profile for this year. Choppy down first half and then a bounce in the second half. We might eke out positive returns for the year, but that's a huge if, and a lot of variables have to come together for that to play out.
I just want to go back to this story that's on the Bloomberg terminal by our own Steve Matthews, who follows the Fed. He's a Bloomberg News economics reporter, and he caught up, and the Bloomberg News team caught up with the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta President Rafael Bostic. I mean, another thing, Amanda, that Steve got from Bostic is that he expected inflation to be in the low threes this year, still well above the Fed's 2% target, you know, requiring rates to be higher for longer. But low threes, I mean, that gets to start feel more normal, right, historically.
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you think about the 10 plus years leading up to the onset of the pandemic, we undershot in a big way in the inflation target. So I think there's definitely a period of time here where the pendulum can swing and stay not at current levels, but certainly stay at a more elevated level of inflation relative to that target. And by the way, that three kind of handle on inflation scenario is actually really good for earnings growth and for valuation multiple expansion. So we think the backdrop can handle that very well. I actually think landing there is probably better than hammering away at this and trying to get to that 2% target.
You said that was really good for earnings growth and what else?
Valuation multiple expansion.
Okay, so that would be a much better level to be at. Really great analysis, and so great to be able to kind of get your reaction to what Rafael Bostic had to say to our Steve Matthews. Amanda Agati, thank you, thank you. Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management Group, joining us via Zoom.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.